You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
It's the first time that Apple have actually decided to tell people about something that they're developing.
High-speed broadband. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
The three main spamming countries are the United States, China, and South Korea.
And I've got some residual powers.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Senator Coonan, the voice of reason.
There's a couple of systems on a gantry that's actually based on a military missile tracking system.
You put the date on ePray, and you get a whole service just on it.
How does it go?
IE7, you were having trouble installing it because you had a genuine copy of Windows that wouldn't validate properly. What did you have to do to get past that?
Built a new machine.
But how hard can it be?
Well, it's not hard at all.
At the end of the day, the photography is all about the person's eye and what they see.
If you find something that's inappropriate about your child, you need to do something about it because it will not go away.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Tech Talk Radio. I'm your host, Andrew McColl. Christmas is coming, and so too is the holiday period where we all let our hair down to celebrate the passing of yet another year. So in the lead up to logging off for the year and checking your brain at the door on the way out, tonight's show will be a timely reminder of what to do and what not to do when it comes to securing your favourite gadgets and technology before going on holidays. Large screen TVs are the flavour of the month at the moment for those who seem intent on taking what's not theirs. And in most cases, they're very easy to remove from the walls as there's only a couple of screws holding them in place. The other obvious target at the moment is laptops and cameras, things which can easily be hocked at the local cash converters or sold at the pub or at universities. When it comes to laptops, it's not so much the hardware, it's the software and sometimes the hard work which is contained on the hard drive. Also, keep in mind the bag which it lives in, along with the mobile broadband card and other accessories that are kept in the same bag. Mobile phones and broadband cards can easily be traced these days, so keeping a record of the device's IMEI number can be a way to find a stolen device, and it may also lead to the apprehension of those who liberated your gear from you in the first place. IMEI is an abbreviation for International Mobile Equipment Identity and is a 15-digit code used to identify a phone to the network. If a stolen device appears on a carrier's phone network, the authorities can be notified and chances are you may get your phone or mobile broadband card back. So if you're planning a trip away or even just going out for a few hours, we'll tell you what to do to maximise your chance of property being returned to you should the worst case scenario happen while you're away enjoying your break.
This week on Tech Talk Radio.
Telstra demonstrates 21 megabits per second on NextG. India inserts Chandrayaan 1 into moon orbit. Researchers crack WPA encryption. IBM adds Mac support to Lotus Notes. And Adam Turner looks to upgrade the humble telephone, which sits on the bench in the kitchen. So stay tuned for all that and much, much more. First up, though, here's the latest happenings from the Tech Talk News Desk.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, India inserts Chandrayaan 1 into moon orbit, researchers crack WPA encryption, the BBC suffers a denial of service attack, and Microsoft's CEO pours cold water on Yahoo. This is Tech Talk News. This week, Telstra gave its first demonstration of enhanced HSDPA with its NextG network, using a modem developed by Sierra Wireless capable of a maximum downstream speed of 21 megabits per second. Telstra is promising commercial services early in 2009. Telstra and Sierra Wireless announced last month that they were developing the product in conjunction with NextG network supplier Ericsson and Sierra's chip manufacturer Qualcomm. They said then that the shipments for customer trials are expected to begin in the coming months, with a commercial launch to follow. Mike Wright, Telstra's Executive Director of Wireless Engineering and Operations, confirmed at the Telstra's Investor Day briefing that Telstra was on track to upgrade the network by the end of the year and to launch a commercial service in early 2009. Sierra Wireless CEO Jason Cohenour said that Telstra was pushing its suppliers hard to enable it to deliver the highest speeds, and this is a very cutting-edge development effort that they were undergoing with Telstra, Ericsson and Qualcomm in preparation for the launch of the service next year. On Saturday, November the 8th, the Indian Space Research Organisation announced that its first unmanned lunar spacecraft, Chandrayaan-1, has been placed successfully in orbit about the moon. The Chandrayaan-1 spacecraft was placed into a 7,500-kilometre by 500-kilometre orbit around the moon. Upon insertion into its 10-hour preliminary lunar orbit, the director of the Indian Space Research Organisation stated that the liquid apogee motor on board was fired for 13.5 minutes between 5 p.m. and 5:15 p.m. to put the spacecraft into an elliptical orbit around the moon. The elliptical orbit will eventually be modified to a 500-kilometre by 100-kilometre orbit over the next few days. A spokesman for the Indian Space Research Organisation stated that the spacecraft will gently be pushed into its designated slot in the lunar orbit and positioned at a distance of 100 kilometres from the surface of the moon. He added, "The health of the spacecraft is good and its vital functions are operating normally." The lunar orbiter was launched at 6:23 Indian Standard Time on October 22, 2008, from the Satish Dhawan Space Centre. It lifted off for its scientific and exploratory mission through a modified PSLV-XL rocket. Two researchers have apparently cracked a part of the Wi-Fi Protected Access, or WPA, encrypted protocol. Eric Tooze and Martin Beck claim to have broken the temporal key integrity protocol in under 15 minutes. The breakthrough means that data sent from the router to a PC can be scanned, but not the other way around. Access to traffic could also enable a hacker to send false information to a client on the network. The researchers developed a way to get around the router to send out large volumes of traffic, thereby giving them large data sets to work with, in order to break the key using a mathematical formula the pair developed. WPA's predecessor, Wired Equivalent Privacy, or WEP, which was known to be one of the first wireless security systems in the late 1990s, is now considered almost completely unsecure, as it can be hacked in just a few minutes using tools easily available on the internet. WPA2, an advanced version of the protocol, is not susceptible to the new attack and is still considered secure. But WPA2 is a relatively new platform and was only made mandatory in all new products from March this year, meaning that many users may have routers that do not support this standard. Experts believe that this latest development could open the door for a host of new wireless network attacks, forcing many businesses to upgrade their systems to remain protected. All BBC web services, including the most useful iPlayer, were subject to denial of service attacks over the course of the last weekend. According to some reports, all of the sites were slowed down considerably. For a while, the BBC homepage was either not responding or opening extremely slowly. In a statement, the BBC said that the attack originated in a number of different countries, but didn't specify which. When the BBC blocked international access to a limited number of servers, it resulted in a marked improvement of the serving of bbc.co.uk. Server supplier Siemens was forced to block addresses and prevent the attack using other methods like changing the DNS settings. The BBC said it expects to deal with issues like this from time to time and that it has procedures in place to ensure that normal services resume as soon as possible. And finally, software giant Microsoft on Friday dismissed speculation that it might be still interested in the takeover of the internet firm Yahoo. When asked for the firm's plans after a partnership between Yahoo and Google fell through this week, Microsoft chief executive Steve Ballmer told a luncheon, "We make an offer, we make another offer, and we move on." Microsoft had abandoned an unsolicited US $47.5 billion bid for Yahoo in May. Ballmer's comments come 2 days after Yahoo shares surged after a rumor posted on a blog that said Yahoo and Microsoft were in advanced talks to sell the company for between US$17 and $19 a share. The blog also reported that Yahoo's chief executive Jerry Yang would step down from his CEO position. Yahoo officials later said the report was untrue. And that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
The minister's proposing that filtering be done at ISP level for everybody in Australia.
They're talking about blocking illegal sites, but who decides what's illegal?
How are we going to stop people publishing stuff on blogs which previously weren't blacklisted? From a technological point of view,
It's completely unworkable.
Absolutely insane. Oh, so much
turn it down. And you're going to think I'm pulling your left leg very severely here.
Could get some really rich dudes just deciding that, oh, I'm going to buy .Victoria, .Australia, and just outbid everybody.
They have introduced an iPod index.
Sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
Yeah, good.
You've already got one.
Can I just...
I already have one.
He's already got one. From 30,000 feet, you've got quite a bit of coverage to cells, haven't you?
Good news for people who want to own technology.
Graham just...
What is he hitting his screen for?
Punching his screen.
Graham just broke his laptop screen because he was punching the face of Stephen Conroy.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the show, the show that is Tech Talk Radio, allegedly Australia's premier tech talk show. Joining me across in front of the panel this evening, the other side of the mixing desk here is Dr. Ron and JD. Good evening to you both.
Good evening. How are you?
Good evening, everyone.
What's been happening? Anything exciting? It's been a slow week, tech news-wise, but you might tell me otherwise.
Tech news-wise, it's been fairy slow, but there's always plenty to do.
There's always plenty
to read up on. And we're certainly not short of business at the moment.
Being a man of leisure.
I've had a few days off, but that's
all
right.
Yeah, all three of them?
Yeah, all three of them. But
I finished my television program today.
Now, this is the first season of a show you've been working on for a long time.
Absolutely. I've never done 130 half hours of television for a national network before, all by myself, and it's very taxing. So now we get back onto the real things like Tech Talk Radio. But it was like Robert De Castella doing The Run, like 26 weeks at half an hour of television a day. That's half a year. And boy, it takes its toll.
But that's the money-making side of what you do. So now
I'm going to go check my brain in the corner, as I just said in the intro, and have a rest, I think, for a while.
Well, you can. You can concentrate on more important things like Tech Talk and preparing for the silly season, which is fast approaching.
Oh, don't remind me. It's only 6 weeks away, did you know?
I don't want to think about that.
Unless we go on holiday shortly. We've only got a few weeks to go here on TikTok Radio.
Only three more paydays for me, and then it's Christmas.
Oh,
That's a good way to go.
That's one way to look at it.
You get paid fortnightly, obviously.
I do get paid fortnightly, that's correct. Not by TikTok, by other people. But
I was going to say, who's paying you? Anyway.
Yes.
Let's JD, how was yours? Anything exciting? Any Mac news? You came in last week saying, no, there's no Mac news.
Then ComSec introduced
the iPod index.
And then remembered, yes. That and, what was it? The Apple reseller program being cancelled and a few other interesting things. That was last week. This week, the vice president of Apple, who allegedly developed the iPod, is leaving to have babies and things.
Oh, he's... I wonder if they're going to be pink, purple, green, yellow. Yes. What's the other colours?
The special
white?
Red one.
The red one, yeah. Oh, well, good on him. I guess you've got to do that, go and procreate at times, especially because that's what you're here to do, not make iPods, really, isn't it?
I suppose so.
Have you got an iPod? You've got everything else.
I've got the old ones. I've got the...
Haven't you got one of the new generation iPod?
Well, I've got an iPhone.
Yeah, no. It didn't say iPhone. It's an iPod.
No, I've got the first, second generation. I've got a couple of minis and I've got a couple of shuttles.
Okay. My wife got a new car stereo recently installed and there's a cable dangling down. She said, what's this for? I said, it's for your iPod, sweetheart.
Excellent.
She said, what's an iPod?
So the car comes with a cable that you can plug straight in, and that provides an input to the stereo system, doesn't it?
Well, the stereo system comes with a cable that just ends up in the glove box.
Yeah.
So I was wondering what it was.
That's clever, isn't it?
It is. I like the current modern technology. Because normally you don't buy a car radio. Well, people of our vintage probably don't. You just go with the one that's in the car.
Yeah, yeah.
And
well, I don't know. I've been known to rip out stereos and put in new ones.
Well, yeah, I did that too in my younger days too. They call them doof-doof boxes or something, don't they?
I did in my last car. It had a tape deck in it when I bought
it. I remember those things.
Yeah, and I thought, nah, it's about time I got a CD player in my car, so I ripped out the custom tape deck and I put a new system in it. But you don't do it these days a lot.
Well, I mean, I've got a...
They're all modular.
Yeah, I've got a Commodore and it's very hard. I mean, you'd need to get a new front panel and it...
It'd be really hard. And you need a degree in back flexology or something like that while you're lying on your back and then on your side. And
that.
Because something digs into the... Anyway, that's the joys of doing car radio installation. It's not akin to doing a mobile phone installation in a lot of respects too. I reckon that's why people just go with the fly and say, no, I'll take my chances and talk on it while I'm driving.
Plug it into the cigarette lighter, that's the way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Anyway, Dr. Ron, you got some correspondence to open the proceedings this evening.
I do have some correspondence. I've got some feedback from regular forum contributor and longtime friend of the program, Jeff Dudley. GD says, hi, TTR fans. On the forum he posted this, I'm under considerable pressure at work to buy and use Final Cut Pro for our video editing.
Yes, I've been dealing with him on the side on this one as well,
have
too.
Have you? We're currently using a PC-based product, Canopus Edius version 5.
What
did
you call
it? Pronounce it? Canopus? Canopus.
In the industry, we call it something else. Just look at the words and just spread them out a bit.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. It does everything I want. The only problem is the boss wants to use FCP, Final Cut Pro, because it ties in with Final Cut Server.
I should call that Canopus, too. It's called Canopus, by the way.
What did I say? Canopus or something?
You're getting closer.
Am I getting closer? The boss wants to use Final Cut Server, which I have to admit, from what I've read, is a very good workflow tool. I've read on the net that there is an ongoing issue for some Final Cut Pro users that on pans, especially fast ones, the pans become ghosting or jumpy. Also, FCP doesn't appear to handle durations greater than 1 hour and 30 minutes very well. Apparently, it drifts out of sync. None of these issues are there on the Canopus. I don't particularly want to purchase at taxpayers' expense, and I'm a taxpayer, a piece of software that is deficient. If anyone out there has used FCP and has had problems, or if you're ecstatically happy about using the product, I'd love to hear from you on the forum. Now, GD says, whoops, I forgot to mention that Final Cut is to be used on an HD 1080i system.
This is the new stuff.
With a Sony HD EX camera doing the shooting.
Well, sounds very good.
What are your thoughts, Andrew? Final Cut Pro, have you used that before?
Look, there's two schools of thought. Now, as you know, what I do, make TV programs for a crust and do radio and stuff like that. Now, it's a bit like, you know, Melbourne and Sydney. People in Melbourne like having a go at people in Sydney, and people in Sydney like having a go at people who live in Melbourne.
A bit of friendly rivalry.
The reason I think because that is, or generally the people that have a go at one city as opposed to the other, because they haven't lived there. They haven't played with it. They haven't used it, get what I'm coming from. They haven't used Final Cut Pro before. They haven't used Avid before or any of the other composers.
You lived in Sydney for a while.
I did. That's why I don't have a problem. That's going back a few
years.
I'm a Melbourne boy, lived in Sydney, and Anyway, the Final Cut Pro is obviously the Mac-based video editing system.
Right.
And there are several others on the market, ranging from high-end, which you would have to say the highest of high-end is the Avid programs, and then,
which is what you use professionally.
That's what we run a media composer. Yes.
Yep.
And soon to be a Nitrous, which is all really nice. That's the new brand name for it, the new version. And then you go down the other end of the scale, and you head down into the Adobe Premieres and all those sort of things that sort of come bundled sometimes with your software
video
and your video
and
cards and things like that. Yeah. Now, what I would say to people is if you want to get into the video editing side of things, start small. Don't get the big boys' toys. It's one of those things where you go, oh, it's very complicated.
Just dip your toe in the water first, see if you...
Yeah. Now, a friend of ours, the show, Jack Bremham, who we all know from time to time, does a lot of video stuff. Now,
G'day, Jack.
He started off with some software which was probably more professional, and he ended up going back down to the, I think he's using Vegas. I think that's what they call it. I think it's a Sony product. But it's targeted at the
why did he do that? Because it was easier for him to use?
For ease of use.
Yeah.
And these days, you know, video editing's pretty easy. You just plug your camera in through your Firewire and away you go. It sort of records it straight to your hard drive. And let's face it, you go down and buy a terabyte these days, you're going to get change out of $200. So you've got plenty of space, plenty of room to move.
Absolutely.
So I'd say, yeah, if you're looking for that sort of entry level to do your kids' videos, to do the school videos, to just muck around and have a bit of fun, yeah, give the low-end stuff a bash, because it is. It's easy to use, and they make it that way. Now, getting back to the Final Cut Pro stuff, Final Cut Pro, the story with Final Cut Pro is it's a Mac-based software, and its probable rival is Avid. Now, Avid works on both Apple and PC-based platforms.
That was originally designed for the Apple platform, wasn't it?
It started life on Apple, yep, and then like most developers who deal with Apple, they got frustrated, so they moved platform, and they've slowly come back across to the Apple platform. So it's platform independent these days. And the difference between Final Cut and Avid in respects to hardware is the hardware is stored off the actual computer. So the computer's just doing what a computer does, number crunching, not doing any video stuff, whereas with the Final Cut Pros, you end up, it does it all on board on the cards in the system, such as the Blackmagic cards, which does the, how would I say, I don't want to get too technical here, but the Blackmagic card does the conversion from the hard drive to pictures that you'll watch on the television set.
Right, right.
Now, with Apple, as soon as you put a Blackmagic card, and JD is probably a testament to this, as soon as you put something which is not Apple into an Apple computer, that's it. They don't want to know about you. They'd like to say, no, I'm sorry, it's unsupported. You take that card out and we'll help you.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. Whereas the other editors, the Avids and the likes, it's a full turnkey system, which means you buy it, they support it regardless of how it works. But talking about operational point of view, they're very similar in the way they operate. It's only when you come down to doing things that you would want to do in a professional environment, some of the more extra, what's the word? Probably where you task a system more, you give it a real challenge, will you notice the difference. So I'd be saying if you just wanted to cut, dissolve, output, do all that sort of stuff.
Want to put some slides up with some text and
Yeah.
Look, put some subtitles maybe.
They're all as equal as each other when it comes to those sort of levels. It really comes down to your choice of platform, whether you want to be on a Mac or whether you want to be on a PC.
Personal preference. So yeah. GD, you have to decide, I suppose. What?
That's a real sit on the fence, isn't it?
Well, I think it is. A lot of these things are personal preference.
Well, I actually read GD's note, and I dare say he's actually coming from an upper end part of the spectrum. But I play with iTunes in terms of iTunes. What am I talking about? iMovie.
Yeah.
At the low end.
Yeah. Is that the one that's bundled?
Yes.
With the operating system,
so, roughly $100, and you get the iLife series.
And that's perfect for people at home who want to knock up something for the Christmas reel.
Which is exactly what I did. Birthday party shots and that sort of stuff.
Did you find it intuitive?
The early version I did. The newer version for HD, I don't. But that's probably, as you said, I've got used to one thing and I've got to break my mind around how something else works.
Hmm. Yeah, I find that with these editing systems, it all comes down to the GUI, which is the graphical user interface. You get used to something and it's really, oh, I know where all the buttons are. Because there's a lot of buttons when you want to video edit and what you want to do and splitting and adding and dividing, all that sort of stuff. So yeah, once you get used to that GUI, then away you go. The other thing I will say about the sort of video editing programs is that Apple are known for making operating systems, iPhones, anything. The point I'm trying to make is that they're not just a company which develops video production equipment. Avid is. So as a result, you've got two different schools of thought. Avid make video equipment, and Apple make
all sorts of stuff.
So you can then argue the toss about, jack of all trades versus specialised companies.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
All that can go into the mix and stuff. So personally, I haven't heard of too many issues with Final Cut. For example, Coxie's Big Break, which is a Channel 7 program. I think it's a national program. It's all done on Final Cut. It's done out of a company called WTFN, which has a fairly interesting acronym. They're based here in Melbourne, and they do that. And they're a Final Cut Pro suite, whereas on the other side of the coin, I'm an avid.
You're an avid
through and through.
Side.
Yeah.
If you're doing audio editing for this very radio program, you use Avid as well just for pure audio, don't you?
Yes, every Tech Talk radio, you hear audio that's been done through Avid, yes.
Yeah. But if I do editing for Tech Talk, or Graham does a podcast production, for example, we use Adobe Audition a great deal.
And the question that needs to be asked is, why do you use that? And the answer is pretty straightforward.
The answer is ease of use and familiarity with the product.
Exactly.
And the fact that I don't need all of the features that Avid offers you, which you would use in a professional capacity, but if I'm just editing a podcast or doing something simple, everything I need is there in the Adobe product.
Well, I had a simple project for Kinder. They were doing the Macarena for the
Do you do Kinder things?
Yeah, I do Kinder things.
Oh, good. I've got a Kinder kid next year. I'll come and see you.
Okay.
Because I don't do Kinder things.
So we had to get the central verse out of the Macarena, and we had to loop it back and back and back and back so that the kids could just keep singing and dancing to the same thing 30, 40 times. And I actually used iMovie to do that because I was familiar with the interface. I knew how to fade. I knew how to cut at the right place. I knew the tricks for moving forward a millisecond and back a millisecond, and it worked beautifully. I did the project in about 5 minutes.
And you could just use the audio side of it to do what you need to do.
So there you go. That's the thing with video. Don't make it hard for yourself. Find something. And one of the best things I found too with video, and any software in general, if you can sit down with somebody next to you and they can give you a crash course for an hour or two, or even if you've got a like-minded friend who wants to get into it, you've got two heads and four hands now, so you can sort of work together and bounce ideas off each other. I find that to be a really good head start, or a good way to get into a piece of software, so that everyone sort of learns from it along the way. Because the books, I don't know. I think seeing, hearing, doing, touching, feeling is a much more better way to learn than to sit with your nose in a textbook.
Absolutely. My experience for, you know, as long as I've been using computers, which is probably since the mid-70s, is play and learn, and then when you want to learn the detail, there must be an easier way of doing this, then I look in the book.
Absolutely, absolutely. Anyway, if you've got thoughts, come and have a chat with us on the forum this evening, chat.techtalkradio.com.au. As I glance over my shoulder there at the moment, not quite a full board of callers yet, but certainly room for others to come along. You don't have to log in or anything. You just have to put a name in.
Indeed. Adam Turner's in our chat room at the moment. He says he uses Audacity for audio editing. Good features, nice price, which means it's
free. Well,
there you
go. You're about to hear some audio off Audacity very shortly break.
Very good. Which Adam's banged together.
Yes, he did. He does, when he does his view from the couch and all that sort of stuff. So, Audacity. There you go. There's a million and one different software packages out there. But just ask your friends. See what everybody else is using. And don't try and go biggest and best, because it'll take longest and painfulest to actually
it'll
master.
It'll take the most space on your system and the most resources on your system to actually run.
And if you're trying to do it at home with a middle to low-end machine, it'll just grind to a halt.
Yeah.
That's what video does, especially whether it's HD or standard def. It just takes resources like you wouldn't believe. All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron, Judy in this evening. Dr. Graham passes his apologies on this evening. I forgot to mention that. He raced in before and dumped some stuff on the table and raced out, so he's feeling a little like he needed some sleep. He looked like he needed some sleep,
too. He did.
He's been up for a while.
For about 3 days now, I think,
absolutely,
without sleeping.
Yeah. before we get too further down the track and try and work on a rundown this evening, did you know Mr. Boomer's in town this week? Well, in Sydney anyway.
Yeah. Is he coming on our show?
There were calls made, and
funny I should mention that.
Hello to everyone in the house probably listening this evening too. But yes, it was an interesting. Have you seen or heard anything about the discussions and the presentations he's made in the developers conference in Sydney?
They've been very busy up there, haven't they? How long has he been there for now?
A couple of days.
2 days or something? Yeah.
Let's just have a listen to this. If you were in an auditorium waiting to hear, let's contrast it to Mr. Jobs, you know, the slick performance with the shoes, the shirt, you know, the
trademark
lovely...
trademark Apple slickness.
The lovely graphics, you know, the fanfare, the... I'm just trying to think of a good word to describe the people in the audience, but not one doesn't come to mind at the moment.
Zealots.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Fanboys is the Apple term, yeah.
Fanboys. Okay, so just imagine yourself, you're sitting back, you're in the studio, the lights are dimming, we're about to get the man come out on stage, the CEO of Microsoft Corporation, and you hear this.
Gosh, I'm excited to be here.
And you'd be going, oh my goodness.
I've been about a week now on the road seeing customers, partners, IT people, couple developers along the way.
I'm glad I'm in the right room now.
Look, Steve, the highlight of your whole trip.
We in the wrong room.
The creme de la creme, the pièce de résistance.
I think he's had a few.
1,000 developers live in Sydney. I was so excited backstage, I took my tie off.
Oh, here we go. He's going to take his clothes off.
I'm taking my coat off.
Okay, I have to pull a fader down now because it's getting a bit ugly there. But that was just the opening 30 seconds of
Mr. Boomer.
Mr. Boomer out of Sydney. Look, I'm not having a go. I just thought it was funny, actually.
Developers.
Yeah, all the guys up there. So, yes, they were in here talking up Windows 7 and just looking at what's out there in developer land at the moment, and probably sort of passing Vista over as a bit of a,
glossing
a blip
over.
On the radar. Yes. So I thought that was quite humorous this week. Anyway, have you got any other news, gossip over there, correspondence to be entered into there, Dr.
I think
Ron?
That's all the correspondence for now. If you'd like to send us a message or a question, or if you have a comment about the program, feedback@techtalkradio.com.au.
Adam's just said it sounded like he was off his head. Yes, I think he's had a few at the back. Maybe the nerves were getting to him and he just needed a settling shandy or something like that in the dressing room. But anyway... Welcome to Australia, Mr. Boomer. Enjoy your stay while you're here.
Yes.
Mobile phone carriers seem to be popping up left, right and centre at the moment. The ACCC and all the associated regulatory bodies are taking a great deal of interest in what they can and can't provide at the moment. And there's a new one coming into the field again. Just when you thought it was safe to dip your toe into the mobile phone marketplace and go and have a look at what new technology's out there, guess who's popped in now?
Who's popped in now?
Woolies and Safeways.
Oh, they haven't.
Oh, yeah, they've saturated the market in petrol. They've done, you know, well, they did groceries to start with, then they moved into the petrol era.
That's right.
And now retail chain Woolworths and Safeways has been quietly putting the finishing touches to a service that will make it Australia's newest mobile phone provider.
Who are they going to be reselling?
Oh, have a guess.
Optus.
Hey, got it in one. The already congested over, and there's some news on that network too at the moment. But yes, for those of you who feel the urge, you can go and sign up with Woolies. Nationwide, there are about 780 Woolies and Safeway stores. The project will make Safeways a mobile virtual network operator. That's a bit like Crazy John and those sort of guys. They don't actually own the network. They just buy a bit of time off another provider. And this means that the retail giant won't own the mobile network. Oh, yeah, that's the same. They're just piggybacking on the carrier. And the mobile service will be marketed as part of the Woolworths Safeways brand. So now you'd be very confused, won't you?
Well, yeah. I'm trying to think of all the things that they'll try and do, like they currently do with the petrol vouchers. They'll be offering free minutes and things. If you'll get your shopper dockets, and for every $100 you spend on groceries, yeah, that's right. You'll get an extra 5 minutes free a month or something bizarre. Oh, dear, this is a worry. But what it is an indication of how...
mainstream.
Well, yeah, and how very much the mobile phone market these days has become commoditized. It's something which a supermarket chain can dip into and say, we're going to invest in this, we're going to do
maybe
this, we're going to have our own plans.
Tech Talk Radio becomes an MVO, whatever they call them, a mobile... Yeah,
operator, whatever it is.
Come sign up with us. We won't... yes.
Well, it's a sign of the times, isn't it? Sign of the times. It'd be interesting to see what partnerships they have and what sort of special deals they're going to do to try and differentiate themselves from everybody else.
But I think you probably picked it. It'll be you buy $100 worth of groceries and you get a month free or something.
Get 5 free minutes or an hour's free or free talking to other people on the Woolworths
which costs
brand,
them nothing anyway.
Which costs them nothing anyway. Yeah. But and think of how much money they'll make on like their margin... the margins that they would have on grocery items compared with what they'll be making on the phone networks. They would, if it serves to get people into the stores, they're going to make an absolute fortune, aren't they?
I think it's a sign of the times, though, really, when you think about mobile devices and convenience.
It is.
You go into one of those grocery stores at the moment and you'll find recharge packs and of all different carriers from all over the place. So in a lot of respects, it's probably going to... I think they deal with Vodafone. So it might end up pushing them out of the market, and you'll only see Safeways only type, you know, handsets and things which are rebadged, resold Optus products, and take it from there.
Bo in the chat room suggests a network name for the new network. WoolyNet.
Yes. Well, OptuWorks, I've got up there.
Actually,
from Warlock.
The laptop's on the other side of me at the moment. I should have a glance over here.
The TD says Woptus. Adam said Woptus as well.
We could have lots of fun with this.
It's getting silly.
It is. Yeah. Come along and have a say, chat.techtalkradio.com.au.
Do they say when they might be rolling this out? Andrew?
Well, they say they've been dealing, they've been in talks for over 12 months, so I wouldn't think it'd be too far away because they've just rolled out their new credit card too. Just because they want to be a bank, they want to be a grocery chain, they want to be
a lender,
a petrol seller. And
interesting time to expand your operation, really.
Well, I guess so. But then again, some, you know, as Dr. Ron said earlier this evening, it hasn't been as busy. I'm the same way. Bring on the recession. Mm. I'm quite looking forward to having a bit of a break. Well, oh, don't say that. Touch wood.
Yeah,
no recession for this country, that's for sure.
Now, if I can change the subject a little.
Oh, absolutely.
During the week, I've been working fairly heavily in some mobile broadband. And as you can imagine, around the Flemington area on particular days in the last week.
Oh, we had a nag race around there recently, didn't we?
Yeah, couple of those.
Who won? I didn't watch. Sorry.
I did know. I've forgotten.
See, there you go.
Anyway, I didn't actually see the race, which is a bit of a shame. But what happened is the NextG, 3G, etc. data services plummeted through the floor so you couldn't actually access them anymore.
Why, was there a bomb threat? A bus was going to blow up or something?
No, I think just everyone, because Tabcorp and various others are advertising how you can do stuff online these days. I think people actually were around Flemington. And the result was there was next to no, in Telstra's case, NextG coverage.
Did they have a cow there?
A cow.
A cell on wheels.
I don't believe so.
They wheeling the cows?
I didn't see
any. That
could
be why. Maybe they got budget cutbacks and they didn't bring any cows over.
Now, because we expected this in the business I'm associated with, we actually had the iBurst network operating as well, which is like an ADSL cell service, but it's not on a phone network. It's a separate network.
It's like its own WiMAX network, I think.
Yes. Now, sadly, you may have covered this while I was ill. Sadly, because Commander's in receivership, I'm led to believe from a stock exchange report, that the iBurst network is actually going to be switched off in December, which means you're really locked into one of the Next-G 3G networks for wireless broadband now. There is no alternative other than perhaps satellite. Which
isn't there another wireless thing that Channel 7 bought recently? I'm trying to think of their name. The green, they've been advertising on the telly.
Another WiMAX-style network.
I'm just trying to think. It's not iBurst. It's, anyway. Someone on the chat might help us out. They're pretty good like that. But yes, so what happened?
So we're locked in now, JD, just to be used, so we can only use
the telephone companies,
the phone network,
without setting up some form of proprietary network, as I understand it. And I've actually been investigating that because we really need it. Mm. So anyone out there with an independent network, let me know, because I'm desperate to get some wireless broadband that isn't linked to a telco.
Do you know what happened to Next-G? Why it let everybody down?
No. Actually, conveniently, we had the Next-G data manager sitting in our little bus at the time, but I didn't get to.
You should have had your mic going. That would have been interesting.
It could have been interesting.
Fly on the wall material on TikTok.
Expletives, I suspect.
Yeah. Hey, here's interesting stuff. The department, which is ACMA and those sort of people, are starting to scrutinise Optus's 3G offering. The bad press surrounding Optus's 3G mobile network problems has caused the Federal Broadband Department to investigate whether or not its network and that of Vodafone qualify as real broadband in terms of government subsidies. This is, you know, what's their Fusion product that they put up there, which they've stopped selling now because they reach capacity.
Doesn't work, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So as a result, now the government's gone, hey, guys, if you're flogging this, what does it really work? And now they want to, you know, sell bandwidth for Woolies and...
Yeah.
It makes you wonder in a lot of respects. The Department of Broadband, Communications and the Digital Economy, that's our friend, Mr. Ban the Internet or Slow It Down. Filter the Internet, Conroy.
Mr. Conroy.
Yep. That's his department. Had needed to determine whether or not those using the network had Metro Comparable Broadband Access. Acting Assistant Secretary Simon Cobcroft was talking about the other day at a conference in Sydney. So, I don't know. Does that surprise anybody that Optus's network's not up to scratch?
The surprises. By now, you'd think these sorts of networks would be fairly firmly entrenched and reliable and working, especially from the big three.
You would think. It'd be interesting to find out a little bit more about that. But if the government's suspecting, hey, this ain't broadband quality, well, then there's got to be something to worry about, I would have thought. Mm. In other interesting news, the BBC, the mother of all quality television programs, suffered a distributed denial of service attack.
Oh, I didn't hear
from
about
a
this.
Foreign country during
when did
the course
that happen?
Of the week. Saturday night.
Ooh.
So depends on when you're listening to us. If you're listening to us now, it's a couple of nights back, but last Saturday evening, someone from an overseas country decided to let rip whatever you do to do your DDoS attacks, and the bbc.co.uk webpage was very slow in responding, if it responded at all.
Where did the attack come from?
Well, they said they didn't name the country where it came from, but the geeky, boffiny, techie types decided to put in some IP routing and block certain IP address ranges to said servers, and as a result, it stopped.
Oh.
So they managed to highlight it fairly well and take it from there, really. So
they obviously had a bit of a clue. They had some idea.
They do now. And then they can do some creative DNSing, whatever that meant. That was what they wrote in the article.
Creative DNSing.
Yes, which means that if you're using a DNS server from a particular country, then potentially you're routed to a non-routable IP address or something. I'm assuming that's what they do.
Oh, and that's sneaky.
Yeah.
So you try and connect to this site and you go to, this number is not connected.
That's right.
Ah.
Yes, I know a few people. I've done that at work, actually. It's a really good way as a network administrator when they're watching too much iTunes in the office. You go to your local server and you just put in your own entry for iTunes, put it to your own web server saying, stop watching iTunes and get back to work when they type YouTube is what I'm trying to say.
YouTube, yeah. So it goes to your own page.
So you make your own page on your web server in the office and you just route
your proxy server. Yeah.
You just route all your requests from YouTube to that. And
that is Graham and I did that on a network probably decades ago now.
Did you?
Yes.
Anyway, we're talking techie now. People are probably going, oh, stop it. What are they talking about?
Service supplier Siemens was forced to block addresses and prevent the attack using other methods like changing the DNS settings. This is from the Inquirer. And they don't actually mention the country, do they?
No.
So
someone out there who's...
Techies blocked international access to a limited subset of servers, which resulted in a marked improvement of the serving of bbc.co.uk. So they're still making inquiries.
Yes.
Trying to work out the best way to manage it. Because the problem may not just go away by itself. If someone's given out a remote command for 100,000 million computers, it's to start hammering the BBC
or around the world. On a botnet or something.
It might just keep going. It might just relentlessly continue until everyone turns their computers off.
The just moving along too, wireless communications, which is what we traditionally use between our laptops and our routers and computers in the house and Skype phones and netbooks like you're running there at the moment, Dr. Ron. It's the researchers have managed to crack the WEP encryption, or should I say the WPA encryption, which is the next one up from WEP.
I heard about this. So about this, WPA is the considered to be the best form of encryption at the moment.
Yeah, well, there's a new flavour of it called WPA2, which is the incarnation, second generation of it.
Yes, yes.
But the its predecessor, WPA, which is Wi-Fi Protected Access, has been hacked. There's a great thing. It's something out of Doctor Who. It's like a temporal key integrity protocol. I wonder if you can break that with a sonic screwdriver.
Yeah, that's the abbreviation TKIP, T-K-I-P, that you see when you're setting up wireless networks.
Ah. Anyway, 15 minutes they managed to hack it.
That's pretty good.
And destroy it. So that means there's another one you can strike from Lisbon. Hey, if you, I think WEP and WPA keeps the honest people out. And there's another story. We'll talk about that later today too.
We will. Yes, we will. Now, WEP is the first incarnation of the wireless security that we had in our domestic equipment. And that's fairly easy to hack through. And
I've actually seen Graham do it in our studio in front
I've
of my
I've seen him
very
do
eyes.
It in your lounge room before our very eyes. Do you remember that day he popped around? He said, hey, guys, look at this bit of software I
watch
found.
Watch this.
Yeah. And he was relying on some network traffic to happen. So a legitimate device on your network, Andrew, was going to connect to a router. And it monitored that traffic and it was able to, this piece of software was able to disassemble the packet of data and work out what the key was. And then he was able to tell you within the space of a few minutes. He said, yeah, your network key is this. Mm. And you said amazingly, yeah, it is. And I think that, pretty sure that was WEP. That was WEP.
That was.
But you've since
upgraded. That was 12 months ago, if not further, I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah. And you've since upgraded to WPA. And most people these days would use WPA or WPA2 as their encryption type.
Mm. Some of the older devices tend to struggle with that new technology, though, which is a bit of a bummer.
That's the problem I've got in some of my historic collection of only a couple of years ago, is that they'll only connect to WEP.
That's a shame. Mm. So that means that everything else in the network has to use WEP if you're wanting to support the older devices.
That's right.
Well, all I can say is just all the ISPs these days have these great little apps that sit in the bottom of your taskbar or on your, somewhere on your screen, and it shows you your bandwidth usage, normally updated every hour, maybe a little less, and you can keep an eye on your bandwidth on those sort of things. It's just when you go to bed at night that's a problem.
Mm.
Excuse me. Anyway, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron and GD are in this evening. Graham's he's passed on his apologies, probably catching some Zeds at the moment. So
he'll be fast asleep.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And before my voice gives up, let's take a break. When we come back, view from the couch, we're going to talk a little bit about home security too. All that after the break.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio.
If you listen to Tech Talk Radio live, you've probably wondered why you can't chat with the panellists in real time. Surely such technology exists. Well, now it does. chat.techtalkradio.com.au. By popular demand, you can now chat real time with panellists and other Tech Talk enthusiasts. All you need is a web browser, an internet connection, and a comfy chair. Monday nights at 8 p.m. go to chat.techtalkradio.com.au.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Oh, dear.
This water tastes funny.
Does it? Oh, yeah. Good. Sorry, Dr. Ron's just been out to the fountain and
We've got a water fountain here, and last week
there was something in it.
There was something in it.
It's a divining rod.
It looked like it was a divining rod, or it looked like a car aerial or something stuck in the actual
the actual, what do you call the drums full of the water? Those
blue things.
Yeah.
Which have brand names written on them. Yeah, they're them.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just asked him if he, as he was just pushing the faders up. Yeah. Well, how did you check the water cooler tonight? Oh, dear. Anyway. Hey, mobile phone technology's come of age these days, hasn't it? It syncs beautifully with computers and does all that sort of stuff. You know,
in an ideal world.
Address books.
In a test lab. Yeah, works quite well.
Well, mine seems to work all right.
Mine used to work all right, but that's another story. We'll talk about that shortly. Adam Turner took the quest to the next level during the course of the week, which, more fool him, I guess, in a lot of respects. But the question had to be asked, and he now has the answer. Now, the question was, can you get a home phone to do something like what a mobile phone does?
Ooh.
What, like receive text messages?
Oh, well, yeah, but can you get in your home phone, you've got your little message, not messages, what do you call them? Like address book where you can put in like six digits and says Dr. Ron and here's your 039999 phone number and all that sort of stuff.
Panasonic does that.
Yeah? And can it sync to something like...
No, it won't sync to anything.
Nah, that's the thing. Now that was...
Oh, I see where you...
That was what Adam's question was. Yeah, can you run a wireless network or can you do something and your home phone syncs to a regular telephone? That's a very good question in this day and age.
It's a good question.
It is, and it becomes the topic of tonight's discussion in The View from the Couch as Adam goes in quest of an intelligent fixed-line phone.
I think I've come full circle in the quest for the ultimate home phone. In my house, even a simple gadget like a phone is never just a phone. If it can be a combination phone, torch, universal remote control and bottle opener that has Wi-Fi, Ethernet, Bluetooth and a cup holder. As a result, even the simplest gadgets in my home often don't work, which is not a lot of fun for the rest of my family. Since I bought my iPhone, I found it's also become my default address book, which syncs with my MacBook via MobileMe. If I want to make a call on my home phone and I don't remember the number, I fish my iPhone out of my pocket to look it up. At this point, I'm standing there with a phone in my hand and the number in front of me. So I often do the lazy thing and just call them from my mobile phone, resulting in a big mobile phone bill. Rather than change my ways and not be so lazy, I decided a technological solution was called for. I decided to upgrade my home phone system to something with a decent address book. Of course, I've worked hard to consolidate my contact lists over the years, so I don't want to maintain a separate address book on the home phone. As such, I set out in search of a cordless home phone that will sync with my existing contact list on my computer. Of course, only a handful of phones seem to let you do this via USB or Bluetooth, although it tends to be a manual process rather than keeping them automatically in sync. What I really want, my dream phone, is Ethernet enabled, of course, which lets my handsets automatically sync with my online contact list and has the added bonus of emailing me my voicemail. Throw an SMS, an email while you're at it, maybe a bottle opener or a universal remote control. Well, you know what I mean. Sure, this stuff is available in corporate land, although maybe not the bottle opener, yet it hasn't trickled down to the lounge room yet. I'm sure you could do it with SIP phones and an Asterix PABX at home, but I'm not prepared to go that hardcore. Well, not yet. I've been testing a Siemens Gigaset SL370 phone system, which seems to be one of the few consumer-grade phones which syncs contacts via USB or Bluetooth. It can only sync with Microsoft's Outlook or Outlook Express, which goes against my platform-neutral policy, but I decided to try it anyway. The phone has a feature set as long as my arm. It's a gadget freak's dream, but with functionality comes complexity. The Gigaset SL370 certainly isn't the world's most user-friendly handset, and I suspect it would put a serious dent in my WAF, or wife acceptability factor, were I to make it our primary home phone. Unfortunately, Siemens doesn't sell the USB sync cables in Australia, and syncing via Bluetooth has had me tearing my hair out, which is as much Bluetooth's fault as the phone's. When I did get the phone and the PC to talk, the Gigaset software decided it didn't want to play ball either. After hours of struggling with the phone, I had a moment of clarity and exclaimed aloud, "My friends don't change their frickin' numbers that often anyway!" Well, something to that effect. To be honest, I hardly ever use the home phone except to call a few of my relatives. Everyone else is on email or SMS. Once again, I was looking for an expensive, high-tech, complicated solution to a problem I didn't really have, or which could be solved by a $2 paper address book hanging on the fridge next to the bottle opener. It's easy to get so focused on finding a technological solution to a problem that you miss the big picture. Sometimes you need to sit back and reevaluate your requirements. Syncing the address book on my home phone to a computer is a nice idea, but it's a pain in the butt and it narrows down my choice of handsets to a few expensive and complicated options. If I forgo the syncing feature, I've got a lot more handsets to choose from, which increases my chances of finding a phone that meets my other criteria. I know I've got my nerdy reputation to protect, but I think for once, I'll get a phone that's just a phone.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Gee, there's a common theme in tonight's program, isn't there?
Wife acceptability factor.
WAF.
The WAF.
That's a lovely acronym, which I think should be added to everyone's daily up there with, you know, HSDPA, GSM, WAF, you know, TCP. Oh, yeah.
HDMI.
What about DHS? That's one we haven't used for a while, have we, Dr. Ron?
DHS?
That's Doll's House Syndrome.
Yes,
that's right. when the wife wants to play house at home. But anyway. Oh, dear. Yes. But yes, to find a mobile phone, to find a home phone that does all those sort of things is proving challenging. Maybe there's not a market for it yet. Everyone's moving. Why would you need a home phone anyway these days? Don't people find it rude when you ring on the home phone? People want to ring direct on the mobile, don't they?
Well, I guess the WAF factor at my house is that we must keep a landline.
You must keep one,
but what for incoming calls, Justin, or for outgoing, or a bit of both? Or
well, I think it's the
home messages.
It's the security of having a reliable 000 always going to work system.
So if you need to make an emergency call in a hurry, you can just pick up the phone and you can dial a number. Hmm. You don't have to worry about finding a mobile, turning it on if it's not switched on.
Batteries are dead.
Fishing around for it in the dark at night time. At least usually you know where your home phone is, don't you?
Yeah, because we've got no need for a fixed landline at the moment because we've got VoIP for outgoing calls anyway, and we've got mobiles and all the rest of it. So and our broadband is actually by cable, not by ADSL. So we have absolutely no need for a phone line. Other than my wife wants one.
Well, we're having...
That's a fair call, though.
Less and less need for us to actually have a home phone as well. I can see a day where we just don't use it at all and we just use our mobile phones to make telephone calls and receive telephone calls.
And in fact, when my wife rings me on the VoIP number, of course, on the iPhone, I just hit return call, so I ring back on the VoIP number anyway.
Yeah, Yeah, now the only reason we have the piece of wire coming into our house essentially is for internet access.
Yeah,
for
ADSL too. For ADSL, yeah.
Yeah, that's the main reason.
All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron, GD, Andrew McComb.
And I've got a PABX at home. That's not beyond the realms of possibility, Adam. You were talking about asterisk servers there and private telephone systems, or PBXs, as the Americans call them.
I remember when I used to ring your place, and I had to press 1 for you, press 2 for your beloved, or press 3 for the dog or something.
I had an automated attendant at home. That was a lot of fun. That was back in the good old days, yeah.
Yeah, I had one of those, but it was just my Macintosh pretending.
This was a system that ran on OS 2, IBM's OS 2 operating system. Oh, I should pull that out of the mothballs.
No. You can get them cheaper. You can buy them on eBay for $20 these days.
But you just bought a PABX recently. That was for your work.
I did.
You've got it installed in...
For $20. That's not bad.
No, it was a little bit more than that. I bought one for a colleague for $60.
Oh, okay.
And that was... I think it landed in the country for about that. And 8 lines or something like that and 3, whatever it was. But anyway, a lot of fun. Good fun to play with, especially if you're using VoIP lines and stuff like that because you can have your normal copper. Like in your wife's instance there, you've got the fixed line that comes through and you can also have the VoIP line there as well. Because I'm a big fan of VoIP. I think it works very well on ADSL 2 and I think it works terribly on ADSL 1. You do whatever. I don't care what they say. You've got to have really good broadband for ADSL 2 to actually come close to what the traditional phone lines deliver. Anyway, that's my 2 cents for the worth this evening. Now, during the course of the last few days, we had some unwelcome visitors attend our premises and Lightfinger take a few things.
You had a bad experience on the weekend.
I did. Someone came around and they saw something in our living room that they thought they wanted and they tried to get in and failed and damaged and finally found a way in, and I missed them by 2 minutes.
Now, this wasn't at your work. This was at your home.
This was at home.
You had a break-in.
Mm. Anyway, to cut a long story short, they managed to collect a laptop, which has since disappeared off into the sub-ether. Mm. Exhibit B here is my new laptop sitting on the table, thanks to the insurance company. They're very nice of them, actually.
It's only about 4 hours old.
It is, actually. About 4 hours. I was, talking to you on the phone when I bought it. What about this one?
That's right.
But it raises a lot of questions, which I sort of alluded to in the opening of the show this evening, hence the motivation for writing that. If you have a laptop, or if you have any personal items that are precious to you, there's a couple of things that you probably need to ought do, apart from the obvious, which is, you know, write down all the details, collect receipts for them is another interesting thing. But one thing that might slip a few people's minds is tell your insurance company about them. If you are a person who travels with a laptop or a fairly expensive PDA, such as an Apple iPhone or something like that, which is, I don't know, if you were to buy one outright, it'd be $800 and $900 at this present point in time.
Well, my idea then it was about that. So.
Yeah, yeah. If you feel the urge to ring up and tell your insurance company that you take it away from your house, then this is a good thing, because traditionally your contents insurance covers what's in your house at the time. So if you leave it in your car or someone comes up to you and says, give me that on a train, tram, bus, horse, whatever it might happen to be, chances are you're not covered for that piece of technological equipment that you have out in the street. And that's the same thing for a laptop. If you accidentally leave your laptop in a taxi or a train or a airport or something like that, or whatever happens, you lose it, chances are your home and contents insurance won't cover it outside of your house unless you nominate it.
Mm.
So go through and get your serial numbers out and ring them up and say, hey, I've got a laptop, I've got a phone. Fortunately, ours was covered, but it just raises the questions during the course of the time.
Now, you also had your wireless modem card stolen as well, which was plugged into the laptop at the time.
I was just in the case with the laptop.
In the soft case.
Yeah. And the good thing about that is if you keep your IMEI number, which you should be able to get from your telco,
You mentioned this at the start of the program tonight.
Yeah, it's a unique number. It's a 15-digit number, which is globally unique and identifies a device to a mobile phone network. So they know, that's Dr. Ron's SIM card, or it's Andrew's SIM card, or whatever it is like that, and then allocates the appropriate services and knows who to bill. Now, those things are terrific, because if you collect your IMEI number, as soon as someone that has it, which shouldn't have it, plugs it into a network, the carriers will actually be able to say, there's a device which has been listed as hot, stolen, whatever it is like that. And then through due process, authorities can be notified and goods can be potentially recovered if you're in the right place at the right time. So that's the importance of an IMEI number too. So
very true. It's the hardware number that is unique, as Andrew said, and it's unique to your particular device that operates on the telephone network. So whether it's a modem or a handset or something else entirely, you're the only person that's going to have that number. Or that device is the only thing that's going to have that number on any phone network in the world. Mm. So if you record it, write it down, put it somewhere safe next to your serial numbers and all your other information, and then if the unfortunate time comes when you need to get that very fast, I know from experience that phone networks can sometimes be a little bit slow or reticent to hand that information over or to divulge that information over the phone. But if you have it handy and you need it in a hurry, then it's good to have it recorded with your serial numbers of your devices. Now, as a trick, which some of you may or may not know, on most, can't say all, but most telephone handsets these days, there's a code that you can dial which will tell you your IMEI or your IMEI number. And off the top of my head, it's *06#. So if you try that, I don't know what it's going to do on your iPhone, JD.
You've spent too many times in the back of manuals, Dr. Ron.
Oh, I have. But if you have a phone with a keypad and you're punching *06#, I'm just going to try it now and make sure I'm not leading you all up the garden path. It should actually tell you...
I tried mine, but they stole it.
Yeah, well, this is the problem you're faced with. Oh, the iPhone says, please wait, ... That's a bit of a worry.
Oh.
Error performing request, no network service. No, that's all wrong. Hang on, *. Oh, no, I've told you the wrong thing. Hang on, *#06#.
Oh, so you've just raised everyone's memory.
Yeah, I'll fix it in the podcast. *#06#. You shouldn't have to actually push send or anything, and it should say IMEI and then a long number. So scribble that down. The other thing you can do, obviously, if that code doesn't work, if your manufacturer hasn't got that code in the software in your phone, you can just pop the cover off the back of the phone, and there'll be a sticker, usually under the with the battery pack,
yep.
And where the serial number is, you'll also have the IMEI number usually printed.
Now, if you are a customer of Hutchison's 3 network, you can dig in through their online service, and if you look at the devices attached to your mobile phone service, you'll see an option there that says proof of purchase, which is also very handy to give to the insurance company if you need to down the process to say that, yes, you actually owned one of these devices. But also, it contains the IMEI number on that particular piece of paper. So not too hard to find it if you're going down that track.
And if you're using an iPhone, don't bother with Ron's trick. Just go to the tools general settings.
That's a lightsaber you've got over there. I heard
about
it before.
Yes, I'll turn it on in a minute. And the IMEI number is actually under the about box, along with all sorts of other things like your MAC address and your Wi-Fi address and your Bluetooth address and everything else you might ever want to know about your phone.
Yeah, well, it's equivalent to a MAC address, an MAC address on a computer.
In a network, yeah.
MAC not being Apple MAC, MAC being or Media Access Control or something. That's the physical hardware address of the device. Or if you used to have a radio pager, they call the physical address the CAP code. It's the actual physical number that identifies that device.
Hmm.
It's important to record.
Anyway, I since also purchased a new laptop device here, which I haven't even set up yet tonight, which I'm playing with at the moment whilst we're talking. But I was very disappointed that it came with Vista foisted upon us.
So you've downgraded?
Upgraded an operating system.
I did actually ask them if there was an upgrade path to XP, and they just looked silly at me and said, what?
What would you want that for?
Absolutely. Anyway, but that raises the point about passwords in collecting passwords on your browsers, which a lot of them do these days. Mm. Now, it's all good and fine to say, yeah, I don't have those facilities turned on, but just watch out. In your machines, there are passwords and things like that which are stored. And then you just spend the rest of the day logging on and changing all your passwords on on every service that you would possibly know. Now, you've also got to be wary of credit card numbers that may be stored in your machine. Mm. There's all those sorts of things because there's caches. And if it falls into the wrong hands, you'll find yourself spending a lot of time.
Digital certificates as well?
Yes, yes. And if you think about what they could gain access to, if you do not so much banking, because I think everyone tends to use those key fob things that you can now buy, or the banks give them to you, or an SMS system where it sort of says you've got to push these buttons in this order to complete a transaction. They're pretty secure.
Well, the key fob things are another level of a challenge response authentication process. Aren't they?
They are.
It gives you an added level of security.
Yes.
On top of username and password.
Yes. And there's those sort of security processes in place which make that fairly secure. But think of eBay. Think of PayPal. Think of those electricity companies, telephone companies, where if someone gets you a password and get in there, they can... And if, because there's two types of crooks, really. There's a crook which is just opportunistic and, you know, grab stuff and off they go. And then there's people that are bitter and twisted. They may know you and they might be spiteful towards you.
Turn off all your services. No power.
Well, they could do that. But they could also get in there and subscribe you to telephone accounts and SMS facilities and services.
I'm not that devious to even think about that.
No, I know. I know. But you've got to be open to the idea that if someone gets a laptop and grabs all that particular information off it, then that's good. Same with passwords. Your login password. Don't make it simple. How many people do you know that log in with their first name and log in with their second name? Or log in with their first name and have their password as their first name?
Company I work for likes setting the generic password for everybody to do the same thing, and often it doesn't get changed.
No, exactly right. Mm. Because it's easy to remember. Someone can ask what the next password is, you know? And, of course, then there's these password hacking things which are pretty easy. Just boot off a CD and off they go, and oh, it's amazing what you can get. So just be wary, people. I guess that's the lesson to be learned from first-hand experience here this evening is if you think your laptop's safe in your living room, think again. Put it in the car. That's what I'm going to do next time.
Which is a sad state of affairs. You've got to that point that you have to chuck your valuables in your car to keep them safe. The National Australia Bank has a system where they send you a little token via SMS or text message, so you don't need the little keychain fob watch device, Andrew. So when you log on to your banking, you pre-register your mobile phone number with them, and they'll send you a code via text message to then key in for that session, just a temporary password. There may be other banks that are doing this as well. I know the NAB does it in Australia, and it's a good idea because it gives you another level of security. And if, as you say, people store their passwords in their web browsers and their laptop is stolen, there's not much between
absolutely
between access, but you know, between accessing the account and otherwise. So.
I'll just jump in before the chat screen scrolls off the screen here. Warlock saying, anyone seen the new silent banking Trojan with a rootkit which gets past your two-factor authentication but only working once you've logged in to your net banking? Whoa, that's a stealth little Trojan, isn't it? Mm. So there's people out there trying to do all this sort of stuff. And Adam's also come up and said it's vital to add a master password to Firefox, or someone can get it to show them a list of all your saved passwords. And if you've got a lot of passwords, it's very tempting to use those facilities. So, yes, it's all good. And, of course, the other interesting thing you've got too is email. People can get hold of your email by just clicking, you know, opening up Outlook or opening up Outlook Express or whatever your thing is. And, of course, you've got to keep that in mind too, because if you start going resetting your passwords like you do with eBay and PayPal, and it sends you a notification saying, congratulations, you've changed your... well, you have to do it again, don't you, in case someone grabs that email. So,
how many people do you know have Windows set up so that when they turn the computer on, it just automatically logs in?
Yeah, no, that's a good point too. Yes.
A lot of this could be prevented by having a reasonably secure logon password.
Yes, yes. There's lots of processes, but I just think we need to think a little bit about it, especially in the carefree time of the year where you're at the pub having a crissy drink, work finishes, you finish doing your TV show, whatever the case might happen to be, and you go, oh, wasn't that great? And then when you least expect it, you get a mobile call from someone saying, your alarm's going off. Yeah, oh, great, thanks.
Oh, dear, it's not the call you want.
Indeed. Anyway, food for thought over summer holidays, everybody. So please just be on your best behaviour and go and do it. It's 10 minutes of your life. Just go and make notes of things and all that sort of stuff, and you'll come back. And on the odd chance it's still there, good. Oh, one other interesting story too, when I rang 000 on the course of the weekend too. It took them a while to answer it. I had to chat to the Telstra operator for some time. Have you ever had that experience before?
No.
It rang out. I was expecting to get the music, the whole music. But no, the Telstra operator came back and said, oh, I don't know what they're doing. I shouldn't be too long, you know. I thought, oh, that was very funny. Oh, the other interesting thing too, having spoken to the appropriate law enforcement authorities, be wary of your plasma and your LCD TVs at the moment. Apart from the little navmans that sit in your car, the next biggest thing that they like taking off the wall is your plasma. I don't know how they get out the door. They must come out the window or something. I'm sure they'll find a way. But two screws, as I sort of said, from the boys have reliably informed me, tend to hang these things on the wall and the cradle.
Lift your new television off the wall and out the door.
And out the door, yes. They probably won't do it in broad daylight, but later in the evening, if you ever see two guys walking down the street with a big plasma.
Later you, go at your you know place in broad daylight, didn't they?
Ah, yeah. More front than Myers.
Terrible.
Anyway, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The chat, our chat forum, come up and say good day. There's plenty of people on there at the moment, which is very encouraging. So come along and say good day to us, chat.techtalkradio.com.au, where our operators are standing by to take your calls right now. Back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Do no evil, Google sued for $1 billion.
Is it a job for government though, or is it a job for ISPs to provide interlinks?
Hey, hang on, nerd alert. What?
The thing is, people put it on vibrate or silent and you can't tell.
Which is which?
What do you mean, which is which?
You can't vote with your feet because there are no other options.
Oh, did I say that?
Yeah, you might have.
12 megabits though.
Entertaining.
What's the problem, Dr. Ron?
Informative.
Has it got a network port on the back?
Independent.
Do they do that in some
Absolutely
other countries?
They do.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
No.
She tells me.
Keeps your knees warm, doesn't it?
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Thank you to the contributions on the forum this evening. Yes, I will throw out my throat, my toothbrush. And who was it said use Listerine?
Yeah, Warlock suggests, yes, use Listerine. That's... Never use your toothbrush after you've had a burglary at home. No.
What film was that? I'm trying to think what film it was.
I don't know.
Oh, goodness me. Let's talk a little bit more about other technological things as we continue through Tech Talk Radio for this evening. The National Broadband Network doomed for failure, according to iiNet's Michael Malone. Now, we heard from him last week talking about the filter, and that's seeming to be falling over too at the moment. Like,
we had rather heated discussion last week about the proposed net filter.
It was a bit heated, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, and quite rightly too. There's been a lot in the mainstream press about it in this last week. There was a gentleman by the name of Mark Newton who wrote an opinion piece on ABC's news website, saying that he wishes that people just get their facts straight when they're talking about this, and it's doomed for failure. And the government needs to wake up to themselves, essentially.
Well, you think about it, really. Why would everybody want to go down the path of slowing down the internet purely for the sake of protecting our kids? Now, don't get me wrong. I'm all for protecting our kids, but I think that's a role for parents as opposed to government. And we've got, these left-wing people going, no, slow the internet down. Oh, by the way, we don't care about video game ratings, but slow the internet down. Anyway,
interesting to see how things pan out. Senator Conroy as well was saying during the week that we're not the first people to be doing this. We're not trailblazers, and countries like Sweden and the UK and Canada and New Zealand have all got systems like this in place, but they haven't, which is the fact of the matter. Mark Newton actually says in his article that none of the countries that Senator Conroy has cited have anything like what Senator Conroy is proposing for Australia, with the exception of New Zealand, which doesn't filter and has no plans to introduce it. All of the other nations that have been cited as examples offer voluntary, non-government, industry-sponsored opt-in schemes, very much like the one which the Internet Industry Association has already created in Australia. So that's an interesting piece to read.
Let's just get back to the National Broadband Network, which allegedly is doomed for a failure by Michael Malone, the CEO of iiNet. They're Australia's third largest ISP, apparently, and he said that the government's $4.7 billion National Broadband Network was doomed to monumental failure, despite the fact that iiNet itself is a member of Terrier, which is the consortium that's currently falling apart at the seams because, I don't know, they're all getting off.
Everyone keeps
leaving. This currency thing's really given them the willy, so they've decided, let's get off now before you have to start spending money. The government's process and policy was fundamentally flawed, according to iiNet, speaking at a hearing for the state's select committee on the network. He believed there was a risk that the network wouldn't be built at all, and I must admit I concur with him on that, but that even if it were, the prices would be such that most Australians wouldn't see the benefit of the $4.7 billion spent. What do you think about that, boys? Yeah, do you reckon that if they do eventually get around to building it? Well, let's ask that question. Do you reckon they'll build it, or will it end up being what we have today?
Well, what do we have today? We don't have anything today. We have a telephone network.
Well, no. If you look at what we have today, we have a digital divide of consistent and very much, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. If you live within cooey of a telephone exchange, you get absolutely blindingly fast internet connections, except in some spots. But yet, if you live anywhere beyond, 20, 30Ks from a telephone exchange, you've got nothing.
That's just it. But the key word there's telephone. We're relying on a telephone network which was conceived of and designed in the, mid-1800s or late 1800s. And as we've said in previous shows, the actual bit of cable that's coming up the street and going into your house hasn't changed much in 100 years, if it's changed at all.
I pay $40 a month rental on that.
Yeah.
And I don't see them out there polishing it for me.
No.
They're not out there with a brasso.
And you're running data over a phone network, and it works well, but it works well to a point. If we want to actually progress beyond what we have at the moment, we need a custom design and custom-built data network. And it has to happen. Someone has to do it.
And at some point, we'll run out of bandwidth anyway under the current technology. It's a bit like dial-up.
I think we did tonight. Has anyone been on the internet tonight? I think we've run out of bandwidth tonight, gentlemen.
But dial-up, for example, had its limitations. You could only go to a certain point, and broadband will be the same. There'll come a point where you just can't go any faster over the current infrastructure.
Telstra have launched a new unified communications system. Now, Dr. Ron, you're into unified communications, aren't you?
I am.
Well, if you're a Telstra customer, this is good news. Especially if you're an XG or Big Pond user. If you're not, you have to sign up. That's the way it works these days. But what they're doing is they're providing one service that combines email, voice, pictures, picture messaging, SMS, and multimedia communications into what is claimed to be a secure, integrated online and mobile service. So just reading between the lines there, the product's called MyConnect, by the way. It has three components, which Big Pond and NextG all use on their PCs and that, so if you're a customer there. But you have this thing called MyInbox.
Which sounds suspiciously like Mesh or Mobile Me.
It does, doesn't it? Mm. It's cloud gone very local. but MyInbox is an online messaging, contact and calendar management center where customers can access their emails, messages and voicemail all by one simple login. Now, the question is, will it be free from a handset?
And because Telstra like charging for
apart
everything.
From the data, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, to be able to log in and check your email. It was only the other day that Telstra allowed people to browse certain parts of Big Pond without being pinged for it, and it's their own network, for goodness sakes.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Didn't you?
No.
I'll stick with that. You're probably on holidays at that time.
More than likely. But what I do know is it takes forever for me to actually load the Big Pond site, even though I'm on their cable network.
Yeah, well, their life, the problem, really, doesn't it? I think that's why everyone's a bit slow tonight. Someone's tripped over an extension lead somewhere in a telephone exchange.
Is that what's happened?
Yeah. I don't know. It's purely speculation, but you know, that's what we're experiencing here in town tonight. Other interesting news this evening, Lotus Notes.
Oh, people cringe. Good luck with that.
You mentioned Lotus Notes.
Yeah. Well, apparently, Graham's a big defender of Lotus Notes.
Well, he's not here to defend them tonight.
He's not, so bad actually, luck, Graham.
It does actually work well, and there's a very well-known government department that uses it for all of their communications in Melbourne.
I used to work at an organisation that ran Lotus Notes, and it was an, I think it was, in defence of Lotus, it was an old version, but it had no right mouse button click support, had no context-sensitive menu support. If you wanted to select something, you had to hold your shift key down and right-click things.
Well, Lotus was written for a DOS system originally.
So. This was horrible, Justin. It was terrible. I ended up just running Microsoft Outlook, I think, in
Pop3 mode. You probably didn't like WordPerfect either, did you?
No, I used to use WordPerfect back in its day, but no, this was just terrible. This was only a few years ago, though. I'm talking like
WordPerfect, that 2000 was back when Xtree Gold was out.
I'm talking about 2004. And there was a program that this organization was running. It had no right mouse button click support. You don't know about right mouse buttons anyway. You're an Apple person.
Yeah, right.
Andrew, go on. Sorry. Lotus Notes.
Had to pull your fader down then.
Sorry.
Anyway, just because you might be feeling all left out, because we've got the Mac side of the studio and the PC side of the studio this evening sitting here in front of us. I don't know what right mouse
We won't talk about what machine I'm actually using at the moment.
No, but between that spare microphone...
PC. Yes.
If as a Macintosh user you were feeling left out that IBM didn't want to give you Lotus Notes, well, you're wrong. You can now get the Lotus Symphony has now been launched by IBM with Mac support. So why should PC users have all the fun is what I'd be saying. So,
which probably wasn't that hard for them to do because presumably they were compiling it for AIX Unix anyway. So compiling it for a different flavour of Unix probably isn't too hard for them.
Yes. Well, Lotus Symphony is free application suite for their desktop. Big Blue said that it had been encouraged by appeals from the Symphony community to add Mac support for Symphony 1.2, which is Lotus Symphony we're talking about here. Mac users will find Symphony tuned to take advantage of the Aqua GUI.
Aqua. Yeah.
Have you got an Aqua GUI?
Yes.
You have? Good. I'm glad you know what an Aqua GUI is. Is it sort of like a bluey, beigey coloured graphical user interface? Is that what it is?
It actually happened to be at the time, but it's the code name of Apple's U-Boot operating system, GUI front end.
Okay. Now, for all you Ubuntu people.
Hey, now you're talking.
Symphony 1.2 will also carry support for Ubuntu 8.0.4 Linux operating system. So there you
nice.
Go.
Nice, nice.
There you go.
Another flavour of Unix Linux, so...
Well, it is another flavour of Linux. Well, I'll have to take that on board when Thunderbird stops me accessing all the email.
Didn't I read one of our listeners sent us an email about Thunderbird the other day, an emails or something like that. I can't remember what it was, but I do remember that.
Oh, to our feedback address?
Yeah, someone was complaining bitterly that something had happened in Thunderbird.
That was me.
Was it?
Yeah.
Well, what happened to your Thunderbird?
No, a couple of weeks ago, I remember all the index files got corrupt. I lost all my mail.
Was that you?
Yeah.
And what happened? Did you get it back? That's right, it was too.
No, I didn't
get
it back.
That's it. So all those emails that people had sent you over the course of time, you really can now plead legitimately email bankruptcy. Thunderbird did it to me.
Thunderbird, it wasn't, that's right, the dog ate my homework. Thunderbird ate my inbox. But that's all right. I got over it, though. It's filled up again, surprisingly.
Warlock's familiar with Xtree Gold. I was just looking there in the chat too. Remember that?
Xtree Gold. That wasn't that great. And used to tag stuff to move files around.
It still exists today. It has reincarnated into another format. It's called Windows Commander, or it might be called Total Commander now.
Total Commander. You use that, don't you?
I use that. It's brilliant. It's got everything in it.
And there's Midnight Commander for the
Midnight Command. That's right. I used to use Midnight Commander on something.
Unix, Linux?
Yeah, that's right. On Red Hat, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can you use any of those programs on Ubuntu? Does Ubuntu have a great file management system built into it?
It's got a file management system, which is called, I can't remember, it's got the big footprint thing. Looks like a, outline of a foot. What do they call that? I can't think of the product name. Whatever they call it. The reason I don't use things anymore like Xtree and Total Commander and stuff, Andrew, is because if I go from machine to machine, or computer to computer, I need to be able to use the natively installed file management application. So in Microsoft World, Windows Explorer is what I'm talking about. You have to be able, but people who use lots of different computers and use different computers frequently need to be able to sit down and start using the file management applications fast and know their way around them. It's great if you have third-party applications which you get familiar with, but I can't afford to spend the time installing them on computers that I sit down in front of.
Andrew M. on the chat says, MC is awesome, referring to Midnight Commander. I'll have to download
Midnight Commander, definitely.
Yeah. All right, let's talk a little bit about television in this country. We started off talking about editing systems, and now we can talk about deliverables from broadcasters to the PC / switched on multimedia living room these days.
GNOME is the one I was thinking of. Thanks, GNOME-eater. Yeah, you're right. It's not a file manager. It's the whole desktop, but yeah. Sorry, that's the footprint. Go on.
Oh, you found it. It's called GNOME.
GNOME. Okay. That's right.
Well, IPTV is to take off in Australia. Now, we've talked about this for a while, IPTV. Which is basically video over the internet. It's not hard to sort of come to terms. It's just a fancy name for a pumping video down the thing that's running very slowly today. For almost 50 years, Australians have faced one of the most limited television channel choices on the planet, a choice eventually expanded by pay TV and then digital programming. But now the country is about to enjoy almost unlimited choices with the arrival of IPTV in the lounge room.
Right.
Now, we're starting to see that already with iView, which is the ABC's on-demand thing. I actually used and watched iView today.
What did you watch?
What did I watch? I watched Stupid, Stupid Man.
Stupid, Stupid Man. I haven't...
That's a fantastic show. It's in repeats, obviously, but it's a fantastic show.
It looks funny. I haven't seen an episode, but I've seen the
Go and have a look at it without wanting to wave. We were sitting there watching, because this is what we do when we make our television program. We watch other programs. But if you go and have a look at it, jump onto iView and have a look at that. It was on the telly the other night. It's a scenario around an office where people, they run a magazine, and the magazine is called Cock, spelt C-O-Q, I think it is.
Yep.
And it's a bit of one of those, you've got to go. It's a very funny program, and it's all about office antics, about this national fictitious magazine and who the copywriters are and who the office boys and girls are and what human resources are about. And there was a sketch recently about the fact that you weren't allowed to say thank you in the office, and you had to get HR's approval to do that. Very funny stuff. Go and have a bit of a look. But anyway, that's by the by. You asked me what I was watching. IPTV is that's the technology that was delivering this program to my computer.
Yeah.
Now, experts are saying that unlimited sourcing of programs from the internet is at hand, with new television sets boasting the direct-to-internet broadband connections, which we've spoken about on the program here. I think Adam had a chat with Sony up in Sydney. I had a very interesting discussion with Michael from Pioneer during the course of the year. Last week. Hello, Michael, if you're listening.
Hi, Michael.
stating
he wanted to know what was wrong with plasma.
He did, but that's for another night.
Oh, okay, that's for the next segment.
Yes, he heard me talking on ABC Radio, and he wanted to know about why my thoughts on plasma were the way they were. But anyway. No, I just sort of said...
Tish canning plasma,
I was
you?
Not canning plasma. I just said it was the first technology that came onto the scene, and it'll be the first one to leave.
Well, I think that's fair. I think that's a fair comment.
Now, during the course of the week, I was having a lovely liquid dinner with some colleagues of mine from the Australian Broadcasting Commission. Hello, Richard, if you're listening to us, he runs the outside broadcast section of the... He was just been to China recently. And then there's another interesting story,
interesting.
Too.
Interesting. For
the Olympics, yeah. He was in China. He was telling us over the beer table, the dinner table at the pub, about the censorship in China, too. Gosh, we get distracted on this program, don't we? And some of the things he was looking for and some of the things he did whilst he was in China, playing with his routers and stuff like that, as you do for open internet access, was... quite amazing. Now, one of the stories he told me, and I hope I'm not talking out of school here, did you know, I think I've told you, Dr. Ron, but I bet you JD didn't know, that VoIP is illegal in China?
Illegal?
Yeah, you're not allowed to run VoIP in China.
Right.
We suspect it's because the end-to-end encryption that happens over a VoIP traffic network.
You can't listen to it.
So Richard decided, because they were going to use VoIP to communicate between China and Australia,
right?
So he took his VoIP router over there and plugged it in his hotel room. And of course, when...
Knock on the door.
When you plug something, yes, when you plug something into a network which is not supposed to be plugged into, you get the knock on the door. Now, the question is, how long do you think it took from Richard to plug his little VoIP router into a Chinese...
Oh, I'm thinking it's probably minutes.
Yes.
My guess was half a day?
No, I can't remember what it was.
A day or something.
But they were in his room within 2 minutes in China. What have you plugged in?
Interesting.
Having a bit of a look-see. Admittedly, it was a non-English speaking person who came in and had a look. But I just thought, oh, that's interesting.
Was that a hotel employee? Was that local?
Yes, it was a hotel employee.
Probably saying, you're going to get us all in trouble.
Well, maybe. Maybe, but we should get him on the show, actually. I did ask him, by the by, I don't know how well it sunk in or not at that point in time. Come and have a chat to us and tell us your experiences and stuff like that. But he was also concerned a little bit about the lack of bandwidth for getting pictures around from, you know, like, for example, if he's at an outside broadcast and trying to get high-definition pictures back to headquarters to broadcast to the masses, there's some real issues at the moment in getting HD signals around the planet too. Mm. So... very interesting.
Now, where it'll be the same in this country shortly anyway with the net filter. It's okay.
Oh, yeah. It'll grind to a halt.
Government won't be able to monitor what it is we're saying in our telephone calls using
Skype. Now you're becoming cynical.
Well, it's true. It's the next logical thing that they'll be doing if they introduce this stupid net filter.
I think Grant Hackett. What's his name? From Internode. What's Grant? I can't think of his first name.
I think
Simon.
Grant Hackett.
Simon. Simon, that's right. Yeah, sorry. That's why I'm in technology.
Not sports commentating.
Yeah, exactly. I don't do sport. But he was saying, yeah, it's the end-to-end encryption. He can't, you know, they can give the spooks a packet of that, and good luck to them if they can decrypt it. Well, yeah, there you go.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Now, anyway, back to IPTV.
That's what we're talking about.
We're seeing all these good things coming into the country. Sony, Samsung, and all those manufacturers are now bringing television sets in where you can actually just either through a wireless connection or a blue cable. You can just either through a device that's similar to a web browser, just go straight to these sources and watch them straight on your screen. Now, if you've seen iView, it's fantastic quality. Well, it's better than VHS, not quite as good as DVD, but nonetheless, it works exceptionally well. And if the bandwidth is up to scratch, either an open ADSL1 system, if you can get that, 8 megabits per second, it works quite well on one of those, or if you can go to the next level up, which is an ADSL2 connection, it's terrific, and you can watch all the things that you miss on the telly, and they're adding to it. And this is the start of things to come. We're going to get to see video libraries along these sort of things. You know, the Video Easies and the Blockbusters, they're going to start going all online. And then we're going to get the international providers, which is really going to shoot the locals in the foot when you think about it. And it means that people also, if you do have good internet connection and you're out in the sticks, you don't have to do the 300-kilometre or 30-kilometre run to the video library.
If you've got one of these new devices as well, one of these new televisions, it might be compliant with the new digital Living Network Alliance standards, the DLNA standards.
That's it. That's a specification which has been derived by a consortium of leading manufacturers in this sort of film, Sony's and Panasonic's and apparently Pioneer.
So Adam will be able to plug his blue cable into the back of his television.
Yeah, or wireless.
And not before time, too.
He'll be happy.
What's it going to do to the bandwidth, though? If everyone gets one of these, woo. Heaven help us, around dinner time, it won't be the kids anymore. It'll be, oh, what's on? I don't want to watch the telly or the free-to-air. But isn't it a sign of the times of where television is in this country? Or the lack thereof?
It's a sad indictment on the programming on the part of the free-to-airs.
And what's going to happen with Foxtel? Because last week, Channel 10 decided to announce the fact that its new high-definition sport channel, 24-hour sport channel, will kick off as of January 1, because for those of you who weren't aware, the restrictions for multi-channeling for commercial broadcasters is that they take them all away as of January 1 so that they can do whatever they want. So who knows? I tried grilling a few people at this beery meeting I was at. There were a few other network representatives there. And, let's just say that Channel 7, you might see a fair bit of tennis on a few other extra channels, so you can pop out to the outside court on a different channel as you scroll up through the Australian Open.
Which is interesting, because they've had the ability to do that, and obviously the ABC's been doing it for a long time.
Yeah, they're allowed to.
ABC 2, and they've talked about ABC 3 for some time now.
The commercials in high def have been able to, since the beginning of this year, they got a year to play HD to try and entice people to get a digital telly.
And they do occasionally. If you're watching the guides,
10 do.
Every once in a while they'll have a premiere program, X-Files or something, for Channel 10 on high def, while the standard programming's on standard def. But not a lot. So,
but even high def, what the networks call high def isn't high def, is it? That's just some sort of bizarre product name, HD, isn't it? That's not high definition.
At our delirious dinner table conversation the other night, we were doing the maths on Channel 10's, their two high def channels in a 40 meg allocated
bandwidth.
Well,
it can't work, can it? Technically, it can't work. No.
No, the numbers just don't stack up for good quality television. So,
if you've got a nice brand new television that's capable of doing your 1080p resolution or 1080i resolution, the only way you're going to actually see that in high definition is if you get a nice new Blu-ray disc player, plug it into the box, and you'll see a really nice schmick picture on your screen. But that's not the same high def as what the commercial TV networks purport to be running.
No, there's a few flavours of high def too. Very misleading.
It's very misleading, and it's very confusing for everybody.
Because you've got, as you just mentioned before, Dr. Ron, you've got 1080i, which is 1,080 lines interlaced.
Across the screen.
Yeah, interlaced, grab your fingers and mix them together in a mishmash, and they do odd numbers, odd lines first, then even
the
lines.
Even lines.
Legacy from the old cathode ray tube days of television.
But if you've got 1080p, that's 1080 scanning from top to bottom, from line number one through to the very last line.
What they call progressive.
Frame.
It's like what you see on your computer screen. That's an example of a progressive image.
Nice and sharp.
Very sharp, what you see on an LCD set. Now, the problems with progressive screens is that they traditionally had problems with motion. Very fast image, like, you know, if you pan up and down the footy field, things sort of lagged a bit.
It'd jitter between the top and the bottom of the screen.
That's right. And, of course, you want to get the bandwidth up to deal with that. And that's where the television stations are sort of, what are we going to see? We're going to see more channels with more advertising revenue coming in or less channels with better picture quality. Doesn't take a rocket scientist's brain surgeon to work that one out.
That's it. Doesn't take a rocket surgeon.
So, yes, that'll all be very interesting. So watch this space. It's going to be interesting television-wise across Christmas this year. There won't be much to watch, but there'll be plenty of not much to watch, if you know what I mean. And the video libraries, I think, will be doing a roaring trade. So, yes, other interesting thing, TiVo is expanding its range of services too. I think we alluded to this recently.
Yep.
Whilst we're talking about television, the TiVo subscription service, you can now order a pizza online, allegedly.
Yay.
Do your shopping.
Yay.
don't know how that's going to work. You just surf your way on the TiVo to Gino's Pizzas and say, can I have a Americana with a lot and a bottle of Coke and some things, and it gets delivered. But nonetheless, while a falling dollar will push the price of this device up, do you know anyone with a TiVo? Probably Adam's got one. Have you got a TiVo, Adam? He's online at the moment. We'll have to wait.
Give
it's
a
probably
few
delayed in respect to his response. If you've got a TiVo, it'd be interesting to see what you can do on it. But with the dollar going down and the prices are going up, they're going to be launching an online movie store fairly shortly. Now, TiVo's affiliated with Channel 7, you've got to remember too. So, whatever they're up to. You'll also have the ability to order pizzas, check flight information, and book a restaurant table, amongst other features. Why you wouldn't use the internet, I don't know. But nonetheless, you can do it on your TiVo with a clumsy remote control. So the digital video recorder will also be able to transfer recordings from the device to a computer and will come with a terabyte of storage data. Well, that's about time too.
This is the thing. You have to consider the user interface. If it's a television and you're sitting there with a remote control, you can go up channel, down channel, turn the volume up and down, do some other fancy things.
But try to type on it.
But try to type?
Mm.
JD, it's terrible, isn't it? It's just not going to work.
No.
I've got my media center, which is plugged into my television, and I have a wireless keyboard and a wireless mouse, which I use on the coffee table, and that works brilliantly.
Wouldn't that be the way? If some of these new television sets that come out have a wireless keyboard.
It'd be so easy
to
slide
do. Slide it in underneath the cock magazines that live underneath there. From that, you can just slide out the keyboard, pop it on the top of the coffee table, and off you go.
But it would make more sense to use your PDA, which might have a virtual keyboard or something similar. Would be easier.
The COQ magazines is what you're talking about.
It's the one on Stupid Man on the ABC we were talking about earlier.
Yes.
I was just following down
sorry,
that.
Sorry, I'm just making sure.
Yeah, no, that's
clarify
good.
That. Good.
Yeah, good.
No, you're right. It'd be very easy to do. Just have wireless keyboard, wireless
or
mouse.
Or a little netbook.
Or a little netbook or some sort of interface where you could type easily because the remote control's not the answer for that sort of stuff.
No.
How do you find your media station these days?
Brilliant. Works well.
Does it?
Yeah.
How's the WAF compatibility?
The WAF factor is pretty good. Yeah, that she uses
it. If you don't know what we're talking about, listen, rewind the podcast and go back and listen to the beginning of the show.
WAF acceptability factor. Thanks, Adam. Yeah, it's pretty good. And I've got her well trained. She turns it on, turns the media center on when the computer comes on, turns on the sound system, and immediately starts browsing the network looking for things to watch.
Speaking of WAF,
not stuff that's been illegally downloaded. She's looking for movies that I've put there and other things.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
The you know, the remote control.
Not stuff illegally downloaded. Yes. Go.
That I bought recently.
Yeah.
I've given up on that in a bad joke.
Have you? Why? That was the gadget of the week.
It was. It was. But I just cannot seem, with the technology combination that I have, it gets awfully confused with things, and I've given up. Well, then my laptop got nicked, so that was the end of it.
But that's when you need it to be learning. And those things do learn.
Yes, so they
when
do.
When you've got a weird combination, you need it to be able to learn.
Yes, but I haven't had the time to learn anything for ages. Right. But it's a Christmas project now. Mm. It'll be in the summer series of Tech Talk Radio.
Excellent.
When that'll come to fruition.
We're going to have a how-to from Andrew.
Yes, maybe. It's a good Christmas present stocking for the person that has it all, I think, those sort of remote control.
The person that you want to frustrate.
Yes. Anyway, in a couple of other brief points before we go to the website, gadget, and Oddspot for the week this week, Hack paves the way to unlock Android, Android being Google's new operating system.
It's been jailbreaked.
Already.
Sounds like it.
Isn't it an open already. System?
Well, I would have thought so.
Why do you have to jailbreak Android?
Because you jailbreak an iPod, you might as well jailbreak that.
Yeah.
Google's first foray into the world of mobile phones, the Android G1, has been hacked just a few days after being released into the wild using an application called P-Terminal, which is freely available through the Android Marketplace. The Android Marketplace. Users can gain access to the root level of the operating system and tinker about with its innards to their heart's content.
Oh.
But isn't that what it's all about, I would have thought? That's what an open source operating system is about. You can customize it.
Is it open source, though? Is Android open source?
I thought it was. We'll have to check. But if it
yeah,
is
I thought
open,
it was.
If it is open source, then the code's out there for everyone to look at. So jailbreaking's sort of a way to describe the process, but it's not like jailbreaking an iPhone where Apple don't want you to do it. Here, Google actually giving you all the tools to be able to do it.
Right, right.
I would have thought.
Hmm.
Smart Company, which is one of the e-online newsletters, was touting some very interesting stuff during the week. One of them was, is Google Chrome a Trojan horse?
Is Google Chrome
this is Google's new
a
web
Trojan
browser that,
horse?
Yes.
Right. Why are people suggesting that?
Well, they're saying while internet giant Google has continued to offer popular tools such as Maps, Docs, News, and Picasa, some are questioning the group's invasion of privacy.
Oh.
See where they're going with this? The latest in the firing line is the web browser Chrome, which some say is providing Google private information about users that should not normally be revealed. So, I don't know. Do you put information into Chrome? I don't think I've ever put information into Chrome, apart from the fact that they will probably maybe somehow pick up on my surfing habits when I go to different sites and they can see where I've been.
I haven't been using Chrome a great deal.
Scuttlebutt and speculation. I used it for a while when it first came out, but I've gone back to the habit-forming traditional Firefox.
The Firefox FF.
That's the one.
That's the one that I've been using.
So,
but at least the one I'm using right at the moment as we speak. But Chrome, Graham Callaghan's a big proponent of Chrome. He's always gives it a big rap.
That's good.
Yeah, it is good. It's good, but it's still very much in beta. It's not a final polished product.
They've basically taken all the good bits of all the other browsers and put them together.
Yeah.
A bit of Safari, a bit of Firefox, a bit of Internet. Well, not that I could see much that's in Internet Explorer that would be too open source, I would imagine. Maybe they've just taken some ideas and worked their own way around it. But I do like the thumbnails. Have you seen the thumbnails? You get the
that's quite
the
clever.
3x3 of where you've been of recent times.
It is quite clever. It's a nice interface.
Yeah, so just be careful with that one at work.
It'd be interesting to see what the actual finished product is like when they release it. If they actually turn it into an active desktop type application where it just sits there and it becomes part of your desktop.
Maybe that's what it's going to come to. It's like with Ajax, you know, they're trying to keep everything local from so you don't take up too much bandwidth. So maybe they do that. Maybe they'll build an application or should I say a desktop into the application so that you can sit there and
that would be nice.
Have something going for it, I would have thought.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you're listening to Tech Talk Radio, Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron, GD in this evening. Before we go, gentlemen, we're going to go to the Oddspot website and gadget of the week.
Is it that time of the week already?
Well, I think so. I think it's about that time. Doesn't time fly when you're having fun?
It does.
We have a lot of people out there. I'd send cheerios to all of one of you, but we'd be here all night for that sort of stuff. There's plenty. Come up and say g'day if you haven't already on chat.techtalkradio.com.au, when we're live to air.
Or if you're listening on any of the other fine community stations around the world, then you can always send us a message on the forum, which is forum.techtalkradio.com.au. There's show notes there. There's discussion about topics of things that we talk about on this program.
Absolutely. Come visit us. Anyway, back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Dr. Ron?
Here I am.
Residual powers.
And I've got some residual powers.
You can't turn off CDMA.
In terms of the volume,
overstating your fingerprints.
Now, this
we may have digressed.
Talk radio.
Bill Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600 kilometers.
Don't open things that are good that you're not expecting, even if they do a thing.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics.
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Over the next few weeks, we'll start coming up with some great ideas for Christmas presents. And what better spot to do that than the Gadget of the Week? Dr. Ron's Test Tube Aliens.
Oh, yes.
Is this week's feature. Have you heard of these,
have you, JD?
Why not be the proud owner of your very own test tube alien? This isn't a new thing. It's been around for a while.
It has, yeah.
Yeah, but it's very clever. What you do is you open the feeding hatch, you fill the test tube with water, and a real live alien will hatch before your eyes.
I'll have to get my son one.
The alien has an LED heartbeat, which means it's still alive. Feed your alien with powdered sloog.
They're at the door. The strobe's just gone off.
Oh, don't leave your alien in direct sunlight or in the dark for too long, or forget to feed him, or he will die. If you search for Test Tube Alien on YouTube, you'll find lots of great clips. They're about $15 US. For more details, go to testtubealiens.com.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
Do you know what an ISBN is?
Isn't that something that's on a book?
It is.
Oh, there you go.
It's an international standard book number.
Hmm. It's like an IMEI.
It is.
But only for a book.
It's an IMEI for a book. You're right. It's assigned to each edition and variation, accepting reprintings of a book. The ISBN's 13 digits long if assigned after January 1st, 2007, and 10 digits long if assigned before 2007.
Well, an IMEI's 15 digits long.
That's right. So it's very similar, and it's assigned by a National ISBN Association. I've been cataloguing some books of recent times.
Oh, you've got to get out more often.
The closet librarian.
My therapist tells me that it's good for, yes, my condition. Now, if you're wanting to find the ISBN number of a book, or you've got the ISBN of a book and you want to find out its publication details if they're not printed inside the front cover of the book, go to a site like www.abebooks.com. And that has an online ISBN search engine. So you can type in the ISBN number, and it'll tell you the title, the author, the publisher, the publication date, whether it's a hardback or a paperback, whatever. Or you can type in the title and get all other information returned as well. So there's actually an online database there, abebooks.com. But you can also punch them into Google. Google is not quite as expansive as this database I've found. That must have different sources. But you can go to Google and type ISBN colon and then the number, and it'll bring up all the information.
So very good.
There you go. That's the Tech Talk Radio website of the week, abooks.com.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
It looks as if it belongs aboard Doctor Who's TARDIS and needs a fan belt from a 36-year-old Toyota Corolla to get going, but experts are betting that an old refrigerator-sized tape recorder can help to analyse fresh data from NASA's Apollo missions to the moon. Improbable as it sounds, the 1960s vintage IBM 729 Mark V and the 173 untouched magnet tapes from Apollos 11, 12 and 14 are housed at a data recovery firm in Perth. The information contained on the tapes, which deals with lunar dust, is unique and valuable. NASA misplaced the original tapes and revealed the blunder only in 2006. It could benefit from the information contained on the copies in Perth for its planned return to the moon. What they're now looking for is a 1960s... No, they're looking for a 36-year-old Toyota Corolla fan belt to drive the machine to read the data off the tapes. If you've got a Toyota Corolla in your backyard that's not going anywhere, you can donate a fan belt
to NASA.
Send it through.
So they spent billions of dollars to collect some data and then lost it for 30 years.
They lost it and they didn't tell anyone, but now they've worked out...
They're too embarrassed to, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they can get it back off this old backups, but they've got to find the right sort of fan belt.
And somehow it managed to find its way to Western Australia.
It did. Thanks, GD, for that last-minute contribution tonight.
Absolutely. Yes. That's about it for us this evening. Wherever you might be listening to us around Australia or around the world on the pod and all those sort of things, we'll be back the same time next week. We've got to say a cheerio because someone asked us to Stryker from iNet on air or something like that. So there you go.
Hi, Stryker. Hi, iNet.
Send us your cheerios on the chat and we'll do all those sort of things, maybe, maybe not. All right. It's been great this week. And yes, we'll be doing a music competition because Adam wants to very shortly as well. Thanks, everyone. Until next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron Panelis, Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC and 3XX in Melbourne, Cairns FM, Switch 1197 in Brisbane, 95.3 Huon FM in Tasmania, Queer FM in WA, and Stop and Go Radio in the United States. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.